To order the Higher Education Finance Committee. Members, we do not have a quorum. We'll deal with the minutes later, so I'll start with the agenda. We're going to have the budget presentation of Minnesota State Colleges and University. And I think the chancellor is first. Is that correct? Or is it Roger Moll?
We are together first.
Who wishes to go first, gentlemen? Both of you, welcome to the committee, and whoever's going first, identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee. My name is Roger Moll, and I have the honor to serve as chair of the Board of Trustees for the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Thank you for your time today. In your previous two hearings, committee staff provided a great overview of our governance structure. We welcome your committee's oversight and deep dive into our finances and the work that we do. I'd like to say a few words about our Board of Trustees. We have a few trustees that have served in the legislature and a few that have spent a great deal of time in the legislative process as well as at our nation's capital. I mention this because we understand that Minnesota State is a creation of the Minnesota legislature, and ultimately the legislature and the governor decide what that structure looks like. We also understand that that for Minnesota State to be successful and an even stronger organization, we need your partnership. I'd like to share a bit of information about our system because it directly relates to the conversation we're going to have today on enrollment and our budget. Minnesota State has 7,000 employer partnerships. We award 36,000 degrees, certificates, and diplomas each year. Our student enrollment includes 64,600 students of color and indigenous people. We have 223,000 students directly enrolled in our credit programs. Minnesota State's job placement is 85% in the student's field or related field of study. We know that enrollment is a critical issue for Minnesota State and this committee. I, along with Chancellor Malhotra and the other trustees, spent a great deal of time this past fall at meetings listening to our campus communities, community partners, and business leaders. I strongly believe that the budget proposal before you reflects and responds to the urgency that we heard from our campuses. Minnesota State is the best economic development program in the state of Minnesota has, and I know several of you have seen this firsthand in the communities that you serve. Every conversation we had this fall in the listening sessions we held across the state had a common theme. We want more of your graduates across every industry and in every corner of Minnesota. We know we have to do better to reach students, particularly those who have never been given an opportunity to succeed, and we have to do better to serve students when they do enroll so that they stay and complete their education. And that is what our budget request reflects. Mr. Chair, that concludes my remarks, and with your permission, I would yield to the Chancellor.
Senator Moe, thank you for your service on the trustees. Also, thank you as your service for the majority leader. I remember working with you for a decade or more, and it was a different Senate with you in charge.
Thank you.
Chancellor, welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Chair Pawlowski, members of the committee, my name is Devinder Malhotra, and I have the privilege to serve as Chancellor of Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. Along with our leaders from statewide student organizations, faculty, staff leaders who may have joined us today. Usually there are several presidents in the audience too, but I think this weather may have kept them on their campuses. Mr. Chair, most of my remarks today are on our enrollment challenges and strategic positioning needed to turn around this secular decline. After my remarks, Vice Chancellor of Finance and Facilities, Bill Mackey, will provide the financial data that we discussed, and if time permits, Mr. Chair, both Vice Chancellor Mackey and Senior Vice Chancellor Stasha Green-Steven are prepared to discuss a budget request. Let me start by saying that the issue of enrollment and student success, which I know is top of mind to this committee, was reflected in every budget listening session we held this fall, and is also reflected in our legislative request. In your folders, you have two spreadsheets that illustrate the enrollment at every college and university over the last 10 years. One is for headcount enrollment, and other is what we call FYE, which means full year equivalency.
Chancellor, I'm going to have you pause there for a second. Members, some of you have seen this and some of you have not, but for the members who have not, you have two spreadsheets of enrollment over the last 10 years. This was inserted at the request of the chair. There have been several meetings in my office in regards to this spreadsheet and the impact that it's had. So it might be a good idea for you to have those two spreadsheets before you as the chancellor goes through his remarks. The chancellor gave me his remarks last night, and I appreciate that. He's going to make references, and I think those references, you might want to look at that enrollment as he's making the references. So, Chancellor, thank you, and please continue.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Pulaski. Over the last decade, members of the committee, Minnesota State Colleges and Universities have experienced sustained and substantial decline in enrollment. For the system, over the last decade, we have lost almost a third of our enrollment. When looking at the data, it is important to note that 10 years ago, we were experiencing significant enrollment increases as mainly driven by the Great Recession. So this decline is from a historic high and has been fueled by changing age demographics and by immediate impact of the pandemic and heated labor market. Our enrollments, particularly those of our colleges, are counter-cyclical. High demand for labor not only causes labor shortages, but also low enrollment. This is an untenable situation, both from an economic standpoint as well as from a policy perspective. Declining enrollments severely curtail our ability to provide Minnesota the talent and workforce it needs, thus exacerbating the labor shortages and threatening the economic vitality of the state. Minnesota state institutions are the workforce engine of the state. Currently, we graduate 36,000 students a year, almost half of them graduating with workforce-relevant credentials from our career and technical education programs from our two-year colleges. As large as the size and scope of this impact is, it's nowhere close to what is needed. As a data point, Susan Brower, the state demographer, states that even if all the unemployed are gainfully employed statewide, there would still be 150,000 vacancies. Declining enrollments also has a negative impact on the legislatively supported state goal of attaining 70% of the state's populace with some post-secondary credentials. Along with economic vitality, lower enrollments jeopardize expansion of middle class and enhancement of upward economic and social mobility. Contrary to the current enrollment trends, what is needed is expansion of access to higher education and substantial growth in the scale of operations of our colleges and universities to position them to meet the workforce needs and make American dream accessible to all Minnesotans. How do we reverse the current enrollment trends and make our colleges and universities catalysts for long-term economic growth in Minnesota? Last such massification of higher education was experienced in three decades following World War II. During this time period, and in every other era of higher education expansion, increases in enrollment and graduations were facilitated by two major factors. First, favorable age demographics. As baby boomers and returning military personnel accessed higher education, more and more enrolled and graduated, even with relatively stable student success rates. Second, there were substantial investments in higher education, both by the states and federal government, thereby enhancing ability of the vast populace to access and persist in their education. It is evident that at present, the needed expansion of higher education would have to follow a different path as compared to earlier eras of higher education expansion. The current trends in age demographics work against expansion, and our state has systematically disinvested in higher education. Despite some additional investments in recent years by the state in higher education, we are nowhere close to the legislatively mandated mix where two-thirds of the cost of higher education needs were invested by the state and one-third by the students through tuition and fees. In my opinion, we are still reeling from those decisions. The required reversal of enrollment trends and expansion of higher education will depend on two important factors. First, enhancing access to higher education to those segments of the population which traditionally have been shut out or denied access. This includes Native communities and communities of color, individuals from low-income families, and vast swath of non-participating adult populations in need of post-secondary education to better their job prospects and their economic futures. In addition, we need to focus on incumbent workers and career changers and make sure that we are prepared to provide educational opportunities to all individuals all through their life cycle. Second source of higher education expansion and enrollment increase would be from dramatic increases in success rate of our students. Additional enrollment and increases in graduations may come from additional recruitment or from additional success of existing students. Students who drop out between first and second year are often in good academic standing. It's not that they can't cope with the academic work, but they have challenges outside the classroom directly attributable to their economic vulnerabilities, such as food insecurity, housing insecurity, childcare issues, mental health issues. Over the next decade, if we can cut this dropout rate by half, it will have substantial positive impact on our enrollments and on our graduation rates. The needed pivot will require our colleges and universities to rethink both our operational and business models, as well as rethink our approaches to teaching and learning and our student support structures. This is the rationale also for our system-wide goal of Equity 2030 of closing the educational equity gaps, both in access and student success in all our colleges and universities by 2030. If we close these gaps, student success and enrollments will increase. This work is not only a moral imperative, right thing to do, but also an economic imperative. We will need to expand our technical and professional programming too, and increasingly put out graduates ready to contribute in the labor market on day one. Furthermore, we must provide educational opportunities all through their careers as they navigate changes in the workplace and adapt to jobs yet to be discovered. In this regard, expanding the reach of our technical programs with our high school partners will also be critical. We also need to support our students both inside and outside the classroom. There is need to make substantial investments in lowering the cost to access higher education and create an infrastructure that will promote student success and close the educational equity gaps. I want to assure the committee that all our colleges and universities are working hard to make these changes and strategically reposition to bring about greater access, promote student success, and close educational equity gaps. Last fall, about a third of our colleges and universities experienced stable or modest increases in enrollment. Among these institutions were some with very heightened focus on student success. Two institutions joined in recent years the national project focusing on closing the gaps called Achieving the Dream. Both of them experienced increases in enrollment last fall. Similarly, institutions that have deepened and enhanced their relations with business and industry with a strong focus on work-based learning in many instances fared well from the enrollment perspective. Federally funded TRIO programs, known for their wraparound student services and intensive advising model, demonstrate much higher rates of student success. System-wide initiatives such as Equity by Design, Developmental Education Redesign, Guided Learning Pathways, Transfer Pathways, Support for Technologically Mediated Instruction, and Incorporating Work-Based Learning and Competency-Based Education are getting some traction, and early results on student success are promising. With federal grant funding, four institutions launched the success pilot modeled on CUNY ASAP National Student Support Model, which provides proactive coaching and advising to students in addition to a modest financial incentive. Early results are positive increases not only in retention from semester to semester, but also increased credit completion to ensure students can complete their program of study in a timely manner. Lastly, colleges are deepening their partnerships with philanthropic and local government and community partners to provide financial assistance to students in their areas. This approach not only encourages students who may have chosen not to pursue higher education, but also strengthens the community's commitment to their students with the goal of keeping their workforce talent in the region. Thus, pathways and approaches are emerging that hold the potential to reverse the enrollment trends. To accomplish discernible and game-changing impact, it will require substantial investments in scaling up this work within an institution and across all our constituent colleges and universities. Our biennial budget request will enable us to put in place an infrastructure that will increase the number of students we educate and also have a positive impact on our scale of operations. The student support and workforce development categories of our biennial budget request include initiatives that facilitate enhanced access and ability to persist and succeed for our students. Minnesota State stabilization category of our biennial budget request makes a compelling case to appropriately resource our colleges and universities for them to bring about the needed changes in the strategic positioning and business models to accomplish the expansion of number of students we educate and graduate. We fully recognize we have immense challenges facing us, but our campus leaders and our faculty and staff are ready to not only meet these challenges successfully, but also to usher in another era of higher education expansion. We are looking for strong partnership and guidance from the committee, the legislature, and the governor to ensure that no Minnesotan is left behind in their pursuit of the American dream. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, enrollment is a critical issue, and it is the central tenet of our budget request. The strategies we focused on in our request include student affordability, being able to successfully support students in a holistic manner once they are enrolled, focusing on workforce needs and the college and university partnerships with their communities, and of course, being able to financially stabilize our campuses. With your permission and indulgence, Mr. Chair, I would now like to turn it over to Vice Chancellor Bill Mackey, who will discuss our financial data. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee.
Before you leave, I want to have members, if they have any questions, and I have one comment before I open it up to that. Members, several times in these comments, the chancellor has made a statement, and I'm going to repeat the one I like the best. In this regard, expanding the reach of our technical programs with our high school partners will also be critical. To that extent, yesterday, Chair Wayukim and I had our first meeting on what will be a joint hearing of the K-12 Finance and the Higher Education Committee solely on this topic. The Chancellor and Roger Moe were in my office yesterday to begin the discussion of setting up that hearing. I've also already invited the Chamber of Commerce and the Business Partnership as critical to that hearing. I'm going to meet with both caucuses. We're going to make sure that we have input from all of them, but I would like to see the beginning of a plan of relinking our, particularly our two-year, with our K-12 system, so that every high school senior in Minnesota will have the option of graduating with an employable skill set. And that will be the thrust of this joint committee hearing. So there will be a reason to have a joint committee hearing of two committees, and not just to meet and have fun. There will be very little fun with this. There will be some hard decision making, I think. So members, anyone else? Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had the pleasure and the honor to serve in your committee the last 2 years dealing with Industrial Education Committee. And you had a pilot project in Winona. I have an 11th grader, and other than St. John's and South Dakota State University, where both of my kids went, the two others, I don't think he has heard of any of these colleges, frankly. And he's going to be a senior next year, and the poor kid doesn't know what he wants to do. Fortunately, he's smart like his mother, so I think he'll figure it out. But that said, Mr. Chair, as I said, you probably remember last time, we need to start before 12th grade, and you know that. And I think everybody else in the room knows that. We start at 12th grade, it's too late. Right now, my son is probably going to go into plumbing, heating, air conditioning, because he witnessed his brother, who went to 1 year of college out of state, because they got a lot of hunting and fishing in South Dakota, see, who's now a plumber, making very good money, loving what he does. He's on his second house at 22 years old with no debt. Already paid off his first year of school debt. So he's thinking the trades route, because that's he's seen where success and the American dream is happening. Mm-hmm. So not only do we got to link K-12 to our two-year colleges, we got to link also the trades as well. And I hope, Mr. Chair, and I certainly will continue to be a voice like many of us here, we start in elementary school, if not middle school, at the very latest, to educate the kids on skilled trade labor, our two-year colleges where they can get a good education, get a good skilled labor, have little debt, and go right into the marketplace making $50,000 to $100,000 in their first or second year. So, Mr. Chair, I am 100% with you. I think we all are. I can't think of anyone in this room that would be not nodding their head and agreeing. So I hope that's our mission to link, but we start earlier, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski. I appreciate that. So our side is incredibly supportive of that venture and really look forward to moving that ball forward. And it's interesting that Representative McDonald wanted to speak because in Wright County, we have the last remaining alternative high school for technical. So you can learn everything from cosmetology to auto mechanics, all kinds of different building trades. And so they are the last remaining technical high school, alternative high school in the entire state. We used to have 65, now we have one, and it's in Wright County. And the other thing that is really interesting in my district as well is Buffalo High School. They were working on a partnership with Hennepin Community College and offering intensive CIS courses within their high school, and then being able to actually graduate with a full AA. And so now I've heard that there's a little bump in the road, and so I need to circle back with them to see what's happening. But, Mr. Chair, we couldn't agree more that this is absolutely what we need to do and partner with our community technical colleges, with our high schools. All of them should be. All of them should have that partnership. So I couldn't agree more. Then I do actually have one question for the Chancellor since he is here.
Yes.
And so as I'm looking through these numbers, and one stands out to me is Hennepin Technical College. And I know, Chancellor Malhotra, you and I have had quite a time with the leadership there. And I see that the numbers have precipitously dropped at Hennepin Technical College since the president in question was hired, since 2015. And they have some of the highest, the third highest drop in enrollment of any in your system. And it just, to me, it shows the toxicity from the top down. It affected everybody. And it wasn't clear to me the depth and breadth of the effect of a very, very toxic president upon the entire university. But there you have it on the technical colleges. When it went far beyond just the staff and the faculty that interacted with him, but you can see the precipitous drop. And I know that you were going to let us know some of the structural changes that you've made so that we don't have that same scenario repeat itself in the system, because we certainly cannot have 7 years of toxicity and have the effect upon staff, students, and the faculty. So I just wanted to ask if you could just briefly tell us what those changes were so that we don't have that same repeat.
Chancellor.
Chair Pawlowski, Representative O'Neill, over the past year and a half, I have visited the college almost every couple of months, some contact, either there personally there or through Zoom or meeting with the bargaining unit and other internal stakeholders. So we have in place an interim president, Joy Bodine, and she came highly recommended from all the internal stakeholders and also by our external partners. And I was there late October and early November again. Dates are a little bit mixed in my mind, but working with the campus community to determine how we will identify the next leader. And there would be some clarity to that effect. I'm in discussion and consultations with the board, and there would be some clarity to that effect by the end of this month. But more importantly, I think what I'm hearing from the community is that they feel empowered. And what I'm hearing from the community internally is that they feel that they have better control over their professional spaces. And what I hear from them also is that they are working very together to develop a shared vision, a vision which is well aligned to what I heard from Representative McDonald, from Chair Pawlowski, and from you. And that is that as being the largest technical college in the Twin Cities area and in the state of Minnesota, that it lives into its full potential and promise of becoming that anchor for the workforce needs of the Twin Cities region.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chancellor Holter, can you just let us know, I know that you had made some policy changes as well so that there was a different oversight over each president, and it was rather disturbing to me to see that his contract had been renewed and renewed, I believe, three times, even though there were multiple reports of harassment, toxic work environment, sexual harassment, all kinds of things. Like it was pretty bad. There were internal reviews, there were external reviews, and yet his contract was renewed over and over again. What structurally have you done so we don't have that happen again?
Chancellor.
So again, we have actually gone back and looked at the policies and monitoring structures which didn't work very well in this case, which you point out. And in that regard, we have taken a thorough review of what we call a 1B1 policies, which is discriminatory and harassment policies, and have attempted to make it much more responsive and created accountability frameworks where it has to be much more timely. And then we have also created a mandatory climate assessment structures for all our colleges and universities. Once every 3 years, they will assess the climate assessment would be undertaken, both from the employee survey as well as from the student surveys. And also the oversight of the board on systems evaluation and assessment has also increased. And now as we work through, it's incumbent upon the chancellor and the system office personnel team to keep the board informed with regard to all the assessments which we do with the presidents.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Dreher. I appreciate that. I know that there were many, many, many balls dropped over 7 years. I believe that the victims did everything they could to have their voice be heard, and it was disturbing to know that central office didn't hear them, even though even pretty intense internal investigations were done and had finding of fact that was pretty significant. These were very professional folks that had been in law enforcement and investigated parts of law enforcement for quite some time that were doing the investigations. That was some internal stuff that came to me. So, you know, as I began to speak out about this, all kinds of people, current and former, began to reach out about their concerns. And so this is, I dare not say this is a cultural problem, but we certainly don't want it to become a cultural problem within the state. So I hope that we take those complaints and concerns very, very seriously here going forward.
We indeed do, Chair Pulaski, Representative O'Neill, and I would invite you to come visit Hennepin Technical College now and without my filter, talk to those individuals and see where they feel currently they are.
Chancellor, I want to compliment you, too. You've given instruction to the administration that they should invite the legislators, senators, and representatives, not just the ones that have the campus in their district, but those that are nearby. I encourage everyone now to go to the campus that you have in your district or nearby and meet with the administration and the faculty and get a good picture locally of what this thing is and how we can fix it, because it is going to be a daunting task for us to do. I bring it up and I compliment this chancellor because 10 years ago, the office had a 180 directive in its relationship with the legislature. You couldn't meet with an administrator or anything on campus unless the chancellor agreed. So you had to have permission. With this chancellor, he's encouraging it, and for good reason, and I think we'll be much more productive as a result of it. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and also for the instruction for us to find the time to go visit some of the colleges and universities under Minn State. As a graduate from Minn State, I appreciate the work. Thank you, Chair Moore, and also Chancellor Malhotra. I think in listening to your presentation, some of the things that you have talked about is Equity 2030. We would like to see the benchmarks and how we will be able to reach that goal and what we need to do in order to facilitate that. Likewise, I think with the last 3 years of the pandemic, we learned a lot. Several challenges that the students have faced, you know, members of the faculty have faced, the institutions, the several things have changed. Likewise, the teaching and learning process have also evolved. We've seen through Zooms, through different models, the technology that you mentioned, the virtual reality, the AR, VR, and AIs have already taken over some of the teaching and learning, which mimics the in-person learning. What is the trajectory for the Minn State to adapt those new technologies and improve that connection, even in terms of employment and what, you know, what's happening on the ground, and connecting students to the reality of what they'll be doing on the ground?
Yeah. Chancellor Milhoff.
Chair Pulaski, Representative Noor, that indeed is the critical question. I came out of retirement to take this job. And one of the reasons I came out of retirement to take this job is there is an excitement and an energy around rethinking one's own profession. And that's precisely what is happening to teaching and learning. Who our students are and how they learn, both are changing. And both will require very different strategies in order to make sure that we are able to put them on road to success. Give you a very simple example. In today, when a professor is speaking in the classroom, in real time, every student can check the veracity of every statement which the professor is making with the help of this iPhone. That raises the question, is the classroom to deliver content? When I was growing up, there was only two places I could get content. One was in the classroom, other was in the library. Today, There is content all around us. So our classroom is changing, and that, in fact, has a significant linkage, not only to technology mediation of the instruction, not only to the fact that the dimension of geography is being suppressed, and there are greater options, particularly for our students who often have to juggle life and work along with their educational opportunities, but it also has a link to the earlier discussion about the need to expand work-based learning. Because now what is happening is the classroom has to become much more a facilitator of active learning, what we call applied learning, and it also, the technology also gives us the facility to expand our connection from the classroom and expand it to the workplace. We finally have recognized in higher education that all learning doesn't occur in the classroom. There is learning occurring in the workplace each and every day, and we have to find ways and means in higher education to validate the learning which occurs in the workplace. So in both of those regards, technology is going to play a very important role. Then the second point I would make is that we have talked about, in policy perspective, about future of work, given the labor shortages. But to your point, as we redesign our teaching and learning, we have to also talk about the work of the future, the jobs which haven't been discovered as yet. And you referred to artificial intelligence, automation, other things. So in that regard, we have to rethink our programmatic structures. We have to rethink our curricular designs. We have to rethink our delivery modes. And we have to rethink as to who all should be at the table as partners to educate these students. And all this within the frame of technology, which is ever expanding and ever changing.
Representative Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I look forward to having more detailed conversation because we need to reflect that.
Sure.
Our budget is what we value, and it's what we want to see, and we would like to see that being included in the conversation going forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Representative Plebar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Chancellor Malhotra. One, I would like to say, not only do you open your campuses for us to come, and I appreciate the invitations I have received and the meetings I have been able to attend, but you also come out to community to speak, and I have been privileged to be at some of those events where you have spoken about the importance of education, not just as a workplace tool, right? Because I hear a lot of talk about workforce, but humans are more than their jobs, right? So you talk about it as a structure of uplifting families, uplifting society, uplifting our world at large, right? So it is more than just a tool for a job. I just want to put that on the record. This morning, in listening to your introduction, I hear clearly that you have listened to the individuals who were in the room, whether they were students, staff, or administration. In their comments, you've incorporated those things that I heard in the room, in those public discussions, into your presentation and into your budget request. I really greatly appreciate that. So as we think about going forward, this morning you mentioned the systemic disinvestment in our higher education institutions by this body, and our responsibility needs to be acknowledged in these declining enrollment numbers. They're not just on the institutions. The thing you've heard me say over and over is we have to look, as we're thinking holistically, about the cost of attendance. Right? It's not just tuition fees and books, but what's happening to housing around your institution, what's happening to childcare, and I think Representative Noor is in that same space. And then as we look at how students learn and develop, we have to think about those. Are we incorporating in that instruction resiliency skills, right? Because the workplace does change, opportunities change. And how are we building into this the classes that also teach critical thinking, which may not have a workplace outcome that can be seen directly, but it's vital to workplace success, right? And for building our economy as a whole. And then just recognizing that students are social beings. As we're incorporating technology, we gain so much by being together. We've heard that and we've seen that over the last 2 years. Just the interaction allows a thought to be created that might not have been there before. So I'm asking you, as we go forward and as we set these benchmarks, to keep the whole individual as well as the needs of our society in mind as we look at what programs we can keep, which ones need to maybe be consolidated, whatever that looks like. But thank you so much for your work and the work of your team.
Chancellor? Jay Pulaski, Representative Claiborne, I couldn't agree with you more. We not only want competent engineers, we want well-educated competent engineers. We not only want competent trade skills professionals out there, we want well-educated trade skills professionals out there. And so to me, this dichotomy with building personal skills and personal growth and ability to work in teams and ability to think critically and independently is not dissimilar to what is being asked, because the cognitive base of knowledge of every profession has increased. I was in a welding lab a couple of years ago, and this instructor was explaining to me what the student was doing at the computer. And he said, and that computer was controlling a machine. And he said, in real time, in cloud, that computer was, and that machine was linked to every other machine of that kind. And in real time, there was information coming back, which this particular operator of the machine had to take into account to optimize the operation. So that's the complexity. And that is why that dichotomy, which is often made between liberal education on one side and professional and trade skills on the other side, is a false dichotomy. We need to embed both, and we need to produce well-educated, competent professionals.
Well, thank you, Chair Pulaski. And Chancellor, I just wanted to reiterate the excellent point you made about the importance of supporting our students outside of the classroom. It's the right thing to do morally, but it's also the right thing to do if we want to address the decline that we're seeing in enrollment. And you had mentioned food insecurity, absolutely. Housing insecurity, absolutely. One thing I wanted to add to that is supporting the mental health needs of our students. And it was a problem before the pandemic, but it's been exacerbated and worsened after the pandemic. And I think, you know, we talk about the goal of increasing success rates. Mental health is crucial in that. So I wanted to ask, two questions, Mr. Chancellor. What can you give us a sense of what Mint State is doing to address the issues with mental health in our students? And then also, what can we do in this committee to support you and partner with Mint State to make sure that our students' mental health needs are being addressed and that they're healthy?
Chancellor Malhotra.
Chair Pulaski, Vice Chair Wolgamott, great point. If I missed mental health, that was a miss on my part. Mental health is a very important focus. Because, as you mentioned, even before the pandemic, there was a spike in mental health issues, but the pandemic has further exaggerated that. And we are making a lot of efforts at both at the system level, but our colleges and universities also work through and have put in structures to serve their students with regard to these needs on their campuses. Last year, for example, we entered with United Way, what we call a project United Way 211, and that facility is available to any student 24/7. And if they are having a mental health episode, or for that matter, if they're having any other challenge, they can call up that number 211, and in real time, some aid is provided to the student. They are linked to the resources where they can get help. But more importantly, then that information also goes to the college or university. So the counselor, the mental health counselors, or the advisors in at the colleges and universities can also follow up over the long haul in order to make sure that we are linking that student to the resources which are available out there in the community in order to make sure that those resources are helpful for them to overcome their challenges and persist in their education. And to your point, what can you do? Found our request. because in the student support and equity category, we are asking of close to about $45 to $50 million, which will be really aimed at creating a infrastructure which will enable us to link our students to the resources which are available to overcome these challenges, whether it's food insecurity, housing insecurity, or mental health issues. And because our colleges in of themselves and our universities in of themselves are not operated, are not positioned to provide solutions to these challenges, you know, whether it is housing security or whether it is food security or whether it is mental health challenges. But we can link our students to the resources which are available and make sure that they have that. And the other point I would make is that where our challenges and these substantial investments we are asking in our biennial budget request from you are critical is that at the end of the day, a degree or a credential, post-secondary credential, is the best insurance against food insecurity, housing insecurity, and also access to appropriate health care.
Representative Wilgoin.
That's all, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chancellor.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chancellor, for being here. And I also appreciate that you came and met with me yesterday. I appreciate all these discussions. I have to say, I'm kind of a numbers person, and seeing these, I've heard about the declines in enrollment, but seeing these numbers, first of all, thank you for providing that, but it is stunning. And I try to be a person who makes data-driven decisions, and part of the conversation I've not heard yet, which I know will be quite controversial, is you run 33 institutions on 54 campuses, and all of them except one have had declining enrollment over the past 10 years, and that one did have declining enrollment in the last year. So I think all these needs are very important, but we also have to prioritize, and I don't think we can invest at the level needed to accomplish the goals when we have this many campuses to spread the resources across. I think we would serve our students and our state and our taxpayers much better if we considered a plan of some level of consolidation. I know we talked at length about the North Campus and how you've consolidated five campuses into one institution and saved some money there, but you still have the five campuses. And my concern is that if everything's a priority, nothing is a priority. And when we have this breadth of work to do, I'm afraid that without looking at consolidation at some level, we will not be serving our state well in the long run, because these numbers are stunning. So I know it's going to be a controversial conversation. I do not have one of these in my district, so I realize it's easy for me to say this. I worked in Congress during the base closing commission, and I remember the pain that that brought around the country. But I think it's got to be part of the conversation, and I would welcome this group to discuss a sort of base closing commission to think about what that might look like in the next 10 years.
Chancellor Milhalter.
Chair Pulaski, Representative Robbins, enrollment declines, I agree with you, are overwhelming in terms of the extent of decline and the time period in which it occurred. Pandemic didn't help because during the pandemic, we lost about 10 to 12% of that enrollment. And as we discussed yesterday, we have a long history in our system of consolidation and also a strong commitment because we know what these institutions mean to these communities. So we want to work through, make the appropriate changes in our organizational structures and consolidate our operations where appropriate in a manner that we maintain the viability of these places to still provide higher education. We gave you the example of Northeast Higher Education District where five colleges were consolidated and merged into one, now Minnesota North. Prior to that, there has been other consolidations which have occurred. But more importantly, there is also another element which organizationally is becoming more and more important, and that is live into the full potential and promise of being part of a system. When we talk about our value proposition, there is value proposition of higher education that is easy to establish. More educated populace is economically prosperous, socially cohesive, and healthy. There is then the value proposition of public higher education. And there again, that's easy to establish because of the access and upward social and economic mobility. But where I sit, I have to also establish the value proposition of a public higher education system. Higher education doesn't have to be organized into systems, but nationally, 75% of the undergraduate enrollment in the universities, public higher education universities, is in institutions which are part of the system. And that is important data point because the question arises, what do systems bring in? And in that regard, we have been working very together and asking ourselves the question, what can we do at the system level which will increase the effectiveness and efficiency of operations of our colleges and universities? And I'll give you a few examples. We centralize the provision of all the legal services across all our campuses. There is just one unit at the central level which provides those legal services to all our colleges and universities. Each college and university doesn't have their own legal operations. We are one of the few systems in the nation which have centralized the technology operations, the technology architecture. And in fact, we are in the midst of upgrading that to the point made by Representative Noor. And we are also currently looking at many other areas where we call this shared services. A few years ago, for example, all our human resources, transactional backroom operations, we have centralized those. And these are also not only to bring about more efficiencies and cost savings, as important as they are, very often that doesn't happen, but it does increase the effectiveness. It reduces the risk of failure in individual campuses where they couldn't have robust structures because of the thin resource base of each individual campus. And so currently, we are ongoing conversations with the campus leadership, with our presidents, with other campus leaders, that what are some of those operations which we can do centrally, which will increase either the effectiveness or the efficiency of the operations of the colleges and universities. So we are thinking about that at different levels.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chancellor. I do appreciate that, and I think that effort is very, well worth doing, and I appreciate that it's already well underway. I would just encourage us to think about, with the demographic challenges that clearly our state is facing, and the positive things from technology that we've all discussed in committee today, that those two factors might indicate that 54 campuses is not necessarily meeting the needs of modern education or the tax space necessary to support it, because there are other ways of delivering services. So I'm not saying we should do it. I'm just saying I hope that is part of the conversation. Thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Chair Pawlowski. And I agree with some of the comments that members have shared and the good questions and answers that you've provided. So thank you, Chancellor, for that. And I am looking at this declining enrollment sheet. And one of the things that you mentioned was that students are changing. And so I'm wondering, and I know this is sort of a granular question that you may have to get back to the committee on, but are there certain areas where the declining enrollment, you know, certain majors or areas of study, if you will, that are really on the decline? And if you have that data somewhere, even broken down on a per campus perspective, so that the committee members can see where the changes are occurring.
Chancellor.
Chair Pawlowski, representative. All our colleges and universities on an ongoing basis undertake what we call program review. Because over time, our programs and our curricular designs are not frozen in time. Because over time, the student preferences, student demand changes. Over time, the needs of the society change, the needs of business and industry change. So over time, there are programs which are being discontinued, new programs are being brought in. In the thin resource base which our colleges and universities have, when the need arises for new programs, the only way we can undertake new programs is through reallocation. So that work goes on all the time, but what I will do is give you additional information. We'll provide you with additional information, which will let you know what are the processes by which those program reviews occur and how that occurs. It is particularly the leaders in this area are the technical side of our programming. The technical programs have a long history of adapting to changes in local workforce demands. And they will decelerate, either de-emphasize or discontinue some programs, bring in some additional programs. It is needed, and so. But we will provide you with that information.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was this summer when they opened the new nursing facility at Anoka Ramsey Community College. I was in the audience, and I know that across the nation, this is an area of huge concern: is the lack of people going into that field, and we've got to have people around to take care of us old people once we get there. If you have any quick comments on the trajectory that you're seeing there at Minnesota State in the area of health care.
Chancellor Malhotra.
Chair Pawlowski, representative. Yes, in fact, that's why we are asking $100 million in workforce development in a biennial budget request. And not only we are asking for $100 million, we are also committing that we will raise another $100 million per dollar from business and industry. So it's a $200 million investment. But to your example of healthcare, I think that's why, and I applaud the legislature for its farsightedness in creating workforce development scholarships. And right now, we are in our biennial budget request, we want that allocation to go to $25 million. And healthcare was one of the six areas, high-demand areas, which was identified in that, in those workforce development scholarships, which is primarily to and this is $2,500 scholarship, which is over and above all the state and federal grants. And so this is to incentivize more students, bringing in more students. And at the same time, we're also asking ourselves the question, are there ways in which we can create credentials in a shorter period of time which may be useful in the workplace? You know, at the governor's request, within a span of 3 weeks, we had trained 400 National Guard members in areas, expertise in CNA. And currently, as we speak, again, working with Office of Higher Education and Governor's Office, we are also committed to produce another 1,000 CNA assistants there. So those are being done in a very short-term, compressed manner. So we are attacking this problem at very different levels.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much, Chair. Thank you so much for being here. And Representative Scott, we must be on the same thought process today, because I was just wondering around some of that workforce in healthcare in the Med City. I know there's been a lot of partnership with our local colleges. And so those are, you know, areas that I'm very familiar with. But I wonder about the other colleges that I'm less familiar with. Is there equal partnership with the business communities that thrive in those communities to make sure that the programs are tailored to the needs of those communities? I know in Rochester they've done a great job about that, but I'm not sure about some of these other facilities and how that partnership looks throughout the state. Could you help me understand that?
Sure.
Chancellor Milhouser.
Yeah. Chair Pulaski, Representative. I think all our colleges and universities take a lot of pride in building very strong partnerships. And there are examples we can provide you from almost all our colleges and universities. I know Rochester Community and Technical College does a wonderful job in that regard, and I agree with you. But this is a strong tradition which permeates all our colleges and universities.
Representative Hicks.
That's all. Thank you.
Representative McDonald.
Mr. Chair, I'll make this quite quick. Since I forgot, I did have a question for you, Chancellor. But first, I just want to just mention the Wright Technical Center in Buffalo, one of the few in the state of Minnesota. My son is going to, and they're building a house. The bus company in Delano said it's the largest group of kids that they're bringing from Wright County, or at least from Delano, to Wright Tech that they've done in a number of years. So that's reassuring. I think that's a positive growth for that industry. Secondly, Joy Bordine, your president of the Hennepin Technical Center, my old alma mater. Excellent choice. She was my neighbor, right next door neighbor in Delano. She's sharp as a whip. So I entertain an invitation to visit my old school with you and Joy as well. And it is disappointed to see that decline. That was one of the highest declines there, but I'm sure that you're on top of it. So the question is, quickly, looking at the data, most of the technical schools have the least number of decline. I have a suspicion as why that is. I'd like to hear your take. But also, I worked with a lot of high school kids for the last 35 years, and particularly a lot of the kids in the area, and from Providence School to Wright, Hennepin, a lot of the different counties. They're going to St. Thomas and St. John's and the technical schools and Dunwoody also. So I'm just curious, since Dunwoody teaches some of the skill labor, like some of your technical college, why do you think the technical colleges have less of a decline? And have you looked at Dunwoody? I know it's off the scope, but they seem to be geared up for success as well. Have you looked at their enrollments in compared to your technical skilled trade labor in comparison to Minsku?
Chancellor Milhouser.
Chair Pulaski, Representative. Your observation is correct. Technical colleges seem to have fared better from an enrollment perspective. And the reason is, again, the rising labor shortages. And first time in a long time, they are rising real wages. So the incentive to get prepared and get into the labor market as early as possible is greater. But also, our technical colleges and also our universities, they have done two other things which may have prompted some of these increases. One is the proliferation of more short-term credentials. So the students now don't have to commit to come in for a two-year degree. They can take a certificate. And more of our colleges are also developing these short-term credentials which are stackable. That is, you take one, you go, you work, then you take another one to get to a better job and a better career trajectory, and you can start adding those, and suddenly you have enough to get a degree too. And I think so both in terms of the responsiveness of our colleges in aligning technical programming to the needs of the students and the industry, and the labor shortages and the rising wages, which have also created a greater incentive for the students to come in, would explain that.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's all for me. I'm sure we want to hear from Speaker Moe.
Members of the committee, Chancellor, Trustee Moe, I have yet to meet the president of the University of Minnesota, but I have had three meetings in my office with the chancellor and his staff. Trustee Moe was also part of those, planning the hearing that started today and that's going to continue now probably into next week, not just this, but also on the capital program. It's a rare thing that a committee gets to have the head of the system in front of it for an hour, and not once did he deflect a question from any member of the committee. All of his answers were his answers directed to your questions. So, Chancellor, I cannot compliment you enough on the preparation for this hearing, and we all know that with your help, hopefully, we'll figure out a way to address the problem that has developed over the past decade. So, Chancellor, Trustee Moe, thank you very much for the meetings, and we're going to continue as we proceed through this session. Next up, I think, is Vice Chancellor Mackey, and he's going to start another presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, Representative Wolgemont has a motion for us, and it's a critical one.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the approval of the minutes for the January 17th meeting.
Representative Wolgemont moves the minutes. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, he was excused on the minutes. We typically don't have that person make the motion.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
Not that I'm sort of a stickler for the rules.
All right, Representative Wolgemont is going to withdraw his motion.
Mr. Chair, I hereby withdraw my motion.
Which is also a lesson about the vice chair should be at these meetings. And Representative Davids makes the motion on the approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing no discussion, all those in favor of the Davids motion signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. And Representative O'Neill, thank you for the correction.
You're welcome, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Meg, welcome to the committee. I think you have materials in our packet that you're going to be using as we go through this. And please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair Pelosi, members of the committee. For the record, I am Bill Mackey, Vice Chancellor for Finance and Facilities, and I've had the honor to have been in this role since 2020. Previously, I was a president of what's now Minnesota North College, as well as being a financial administrator at Bemidji State University and Northwest Technical College. Before we proceed with an overview of the financial data and our budget request, I want to spend a minute sharing some additional information related to the process we went through in putting together this request. Some aspects of that process has already been discussed. There were several avenues to receive input and feedback from both our internal and external stakeholders. Throughout fall semester, consultation occurred both locally on the campuses as well as at the state level. Multiple budget-specific conversations occurred with the chancellor and her members of his leadership team, with statewide college and university student associations and statewide bargaining units. This consultation was supported by local campus discussions, including conversations with students, faculty, staff, and campus leadership. Informed by these consultation sessions and campus discussions, the presidents reviewed and provided feedback on the programmatic aspects of the proposed biennial budget request. During the month of September 2022, the chancellor, the board of trustees chair, and the chairs of the academic and student affairs committee, audit and finance and facility committees from our board of trustees participated in a series of listening sessions held across the state. A total of 12 listening sessions were held on campuses in the Minnesota state system. More than 550 students, faculty, staff, business and community leaders, including 14 legislators, attended these listening sessions. Participants provided valuable insights and specific ideas that made it into this biennial budget request that we will share with you. Some of the major themes that came out of this process, and the ones listed on this slide is not intended to be all-encompassing. My colleagues will refer to others as we provide rationale for the specific components of our budget request. As this process progressed throughout the fall, there was a significant amount of discussion related to the stabilization portion of the request. Questions were asked, is this amount large enough to cover current and projected inflation? Should we seek funding to cover shortfalls from past biennia? Amounts more than double the $125 million were suggested and considered. There was also strong feelings that we need to be clear that if we are fortunate to receive this portion of our request, that it does not solve all of our funding issues. In a sense, it is a down payment on Minnesota State's future. Several institutions are currently going through budget reduction processes coming out of the pandemic and adjusting to a new reality of having less ongoing operating revenue. Many of the investments made with Higher Education Emergency Relief Funds, HERF, or Pandemic Relief Fund funds that began in the spring of 2020, need to continue in the best interest of our students, as additional financial aid and additional student services are critical and important factors for our student success, as Chancellor Malhotra referred to in his remarks. The proposed fiscal year 24-25 legislated operating budget request focuses on protecting Minnesota State's commitment to inclusive excellence and ensuring all Minnesotans receive an extraordinary, affordable, accessible education and provide our businesses the workforce they need. The proposed request totals $350 million in additional funding over the biennium, with $140 million in fiscal 24 and $210 million in fiscal 25. The request includes $125 million over the biennium for student support investments, including a funded tuition freeze, $125 million over the biennium for Minnesota State stabilization or additional operating funding, and $100 million over the biennium for workforce and economic development investment that would be matched dollar for dollar with non-state sources. This request is designed to support students, support workforce and economic development, and provide the system resources necessary to maintain programs and services to support the success of the first two areas. I'm going to shift now to providing a large-scale overview of the finances for the Minnesota State system and indicate the importance that state appropriation and tuition are as our two primary revenue sources. The information you have in front of you is from our fiscal year 22 audited financial statements. And as you can see, our two main sources of revenue are state appropriations of $795 million, or 35% of our total revenue, and tuition, fees, and sales are 28%, or just over $648 million. Federal pandemic relief funds have had a significant impact the last couple of years, peaking in this particular fiscal year. So you also notice that the grant amount on this slide is $708 million. That's an increase of over $277 million, or 64%, from the last fiscal year prior to the pandemic.
Vice Chancellor Mackey, do you want to explain to the committee, because the question came up before, how that federal money was used, how the campus got it, and where it went?
Chair Pelosi, certainly. The Federal Higher Education Emergency Relief Funds came directly to our colleges and universities from the U.S. Department of Education, and there were three rounds of funding. The first round, which was in spring of 2020, and all of these have acronym names to them, was referred to as the CARES distribution, and that was the smallest round of funding. It was followed in May of 2021, there was a second round of funding with the acronym CARISA. And then the third round of funding, which was the largest dollar-wise, the American Rescue Plan, or ARP funding, that came a few months later after the CARISA funding. During this time period, that totaled $600 million, these three rounds of funding. And the funding came directly formulaic through the Department of Ed to each one of our colleges and universities. The distributions were based on a formula that was done at the federal level. Over half of that funding went directly to students for grants. So for example, in spring 2020, when the pandemic was just beginning, much of that funding went to providing support to students whose semesters abruptly ended on campus in March of 2020. Much of that funding went to refunding students for having to leave their dormitories and resume their instruction in a remote fashion. And the system was able to rapidly pivot and move over 95% of its courses to online in a relatively 2-week period. As we went into the 2021 academic year, which was fiscal year 2021, much of that pandemic relief funding was spent on the campuses to provide what we would refer to as life safety and health measures. So there was funding provided to, for example, have smaller class sizes, so much of it was spent on campuses. For example, sections where that was at the point where social distancing was a recommendation or a requirement from the Department of Health. So many classes that were in person, especially at our career and technical education focused campuses, instead of having 20 students in a laboratory, it may need to be that there was only 10 in each section. And so there was basically double the cost of doing that. So that funding helped support that, as well as provide funding for campuses to help with air quality, update their HVAC systems. The shift to remote learning provided an opportunity to many campuses, provided more wireless access points, provided students with mobile devices if they did not have them, so they were able to continue their learning the best they could during that time period. And a large portion went directly to students in emergency grants or grants. And in this case, the second round of funding moving forward, it was by the Department of Ed requirements for our students of the highest need. It was more of an across-the-board distribution in the first round. The third round that came, the next that was primarily done in the 21-22 academic year, also provided an opportunity to address many of the issues that Chancellor Malhotra referred to, as many of our campuses were able to hire additional staff to provide additional student services, additional mental health support, additional support for basic needs to help address food and housing insecurity. Social workers were hired at some campuses, community resource connectors, as well as, again, being able to provide students additional funding, or students that were in the highest need, to help go towards their cost of attendance. One of my colleagues had mentioned to me, as we think about moving forward into next year, we will have students of our highest need that started in fall semester 2020, and some of them have received supplemental financial aid each and every semester and will be going into their senior year as that federal funding goes away. And part of our request tries to address that is having funding for these emergency needs, because we found that as a very valuable source. The last point I'll make and see if there's any additional questions is that, because that funding went directly to our colleges and universities, is that each college and university's needs were met in a different way. And speaking from at a high level, our university sector, especially our six residential universities, did not receive enough funding from the federal government to cover all of their losses. Not only did they have the enrollment losses that you have in front of you, but also, especially during the 2021 academic year, residential life was relatively sparse on our campuses. So dormitory income, student union income, and other sources that are needed to pay for revenue bonds and those operations, that revenue just wasn't there because of the life safety and health measures that needed to be applied. So many of the universities were able to utilize some of the federal money in order to cover that. But I know just about across the board, it was only cents on a dollar because of the magnitude of the loss and the complexity of their operations, perhaps, in comparison to some of our other institutions that don't have as much of a residential focus.
Members, any questions? I forget the member that raised it, but I remembered the question had been raised. So, Vice Chancellor, thank you. Proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So fiscal year, I'll wrap up with a few more comments about the HERF funding. Fiscal year 23 is the last year that HERF assistance is available. It was extended from the end of 22 to the end of 23. And some of our colleges and universities had funding left over that they're including in their fiscal 23 budgets. It was roughly 8% of that total $600 million or so that I mentioned. That remaining funding is being used now to cover lost revenues and enrollment this year, about half of it, finish HVAC and technology projects, and to support students' needs through additional staffing or additional student grants. So there is great concern that many of these services that were stood up during the pandemic need to continue because we know that the students' needs are there. So as it relates to this revenue picture, if we compare this to 2019 and we were here sitting in front of you, or when we are in fiscal year 23, we will see that the tuition and the state appropriation percentages will be larger as a source of our whole revenue base, and the grant amount will return closer to what it was pre-pandemic.
Vice Chancellor Mackey, I think Representative Vang has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I was a little bit slow in raising my hand. On the previous slide, page 6, I was wondering, as you were talking through emergency grants, I want to know what is the percentage of students across the system that utilize that emergency grant or are in the highest need?
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Mr. Chair, Representative. We can get that exact number. I would say there's a direct correlation to students that are in our system that are Pell eligible. That was one of the main criteria. So I would think it's somewhere in the 35 to 40% range. Does that sound correct? We can follow up with the exact data, but it's somewhere in that ballpark.
Proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Focusing on our two primary revenue sources, our state appropriation and tuition relationship, and as the Chancellor referred to, the system's relationship between state support and tuition had historically been two-thirds funding from appropriation and one-third from tuition. Over many years of declining state support, tuition increases, and enrollment growth, that relationship flipped to 60% tuition and 40% state appropriation by fiscal year 2013. In fiscal year 2014, we saw improvement in this relationship as the system received more state support and in addition received funding in lieu of keeping tuition frozen during that time period. Continued enrollment loss, modest tuition increases compared to inflation, and additional state support in the first year of the subsequent biennia moved the appropriation back to being the primary source of revenue recently. So you'll notice on the further right side of this chart, the red line overtakes the blue line starting in fiscal 2020. If our request was fully funded, we would move this relationship closer to 60-40 by the end of the biennium. It would be 57-43 in fiscal 24 and 59-41 in fiscal year 25. We expect to end this year 53% state appropriation and 47% tuition in fiscal 23.
Vice Chancellor, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question. We don't have the state grant program or Pell grants accounted for on this chart, and I'm just wondering if maybe when you come back, because it looks like we're going to be speaking some more at another time, if you could also incorporate that, especially the state grant program, because I know we've made an emphasis over the years of increasing that, and it's not reflected here, so that still is state money, even though it's not the direct state appropriation to the Minn state system. I'm wondering if you can also incorporate that, just so we have a fuller picture of really the state money coming in.
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Chair Pelosi, Representative O'Neill, yes, we can certainly provide that information. On this chart, I'm sharing what gross tuition collection was and not net. So the state grant paid for an increasing amount of this tuition over the course of the years because of the increased investment in that area. But we'll certainly get that information.
Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Chair Pelosi. And to you, Mr. Mackey, the question I would have about the state grant dollars, right? Because those go to the student, and that would always be flexible based on where the student decides to attend. Do you consider that to be money I mean, you have an average student base that you could work from, but it really wouldn't give you a clear indicator of how much income you're going to have for planning purposes, would it? I'm just curious about that.
Vice Chancellor Mackey.
Chair Pelosi, Representative Cleburne, you're correct. The state grant is a financial aid program that helps pay tuition and other costs of attendance for our students, and it varies by the individual student and the type of institution they're in. So one of the things that we may be able to share is that we do, when our board takes on their very serious role of setting our tuition and fees for the year, one of the things they asked is, how are the changes in the state grant program impact our students that are most in need? And we project information and working with the Office of Higher Education on that to provide what the net impact would be for certain groups of students at various income levels.
Vice Chancellor Mackey, proceed. You only have a few more minutes, and we'll continue on Tuesday, obviously.
So moving to our expenses at the system level for fiscal year 22, and these are by classification, you'll see that, as expected, we spend the majority of our funding on salaries and benefits, on compensation. We're a very people-driven organization. This 62% for this particular year is low. It's normally in the high 60% on an all-funds basis. Again, that financial aid number, the green part of the pie chart, that number is much higher because of the HERF funding that was going through our system during this particular year. But as we look at this and consider our salary and benefits costs, there's two components of it. One is the increases or the collective bargaining agreements that change every 2 years. And one of the areas that we heard loudly on our on the listening session and hear continually is that there's great concern that we have lost pace, particularly with our faculty contracts and being able to keep up with the market of faculty and having relatively modest settlements the last few years. The other component of it that factors into it is the FTE related to the total employees that the Minnesota State system or each of colleges and universities have. And as we think about and as the presidents manage their colleges and universities, we've seen declines in our personnel over that time period, and it varies from college to college and from university to university. But during this enrollment decline period, our FTE of faculty and staff is down about close to 12% over that time period. And I further on in my comments, which will probably go into next week, I have some further information related to how that interplays with our enrollment and our expenses.
Vice Chancellor Mackey, I think I'll stop you at this point. We'll pick it up on Tuesday. Members, when we're done with the budget presentation, we are going to go right into the Minn State Capitol presentation, and hopefully you'll be able to coordinate the program and the capital requests along with the information that you have here. So if there are no further questions, Representative McDonald, you look like you've got something to say.
No, I'll ask on Tuesday. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
With that, thank you, Chancellor, and everyone. Meeting is adjourned.